This is Janet Gowan welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is Noah Griffin, who has shared several worthwhile stories and love letters. He's a great love letter writer, a great letter writer, a great writer. He's also a great singer and entertainer, which is the point of today's talk with him. Noah decided at some point in his life early, he knew he wanted to be a singer, and he didn't act on it full time until later in his life. Then he decided he wanted to belong to a group that did not exist, and instead of lamenting the fact it didn't exist, he created it. So I'm going to go to you. I mean, it's just the value of not giving up, right?
Yeah, and following and pursuing your dreams. Yes. Speaking about not giving up, yesterday I was talking to Derek Jobert, who is a photographer for National Geographic, and mm-hmm. he's done 24 different films for them. And he's out in the wilds of Botswana. And he told me about an elephant that got attacked by lions, and he was filming it all. And it looked like the elephant was going down for the count, essentially. But it managed to roll over, get itself up, right itself, swat these animals away, and move forward with his life. And one of the things I asked him, I said, what do you learn from the elephants and the wildlife that we can apply to ourselves? He said, we should be talking about our instincts. We should be following our instincts.
Yes.
And every time we intellectualize something, we put a layer of difference between who we are, what we really think, and what we think we should think based upon what absolutely makes logic.
So it's that should. So for many years, you thought you should be doing something else, and you weren't singing full time. And then when, you know, that following your instincts, the fact that you wanted to belong to a Cole Porter Society and found that there was no such thing, and instead of saying, oh, gee, you know, I guess I can't do that, and if there isn't one, I guess there's a reason that there isn't one, and you went and created one, and the entire world has joined you. So I want you to talk about that and the progress that's come.
Well, we had 3 sold-out concerts in a row, and mm-hmm. I've loved Cole Porter, and I've done Cole Porter shows over the years. And my wife, Meredith, came up with the idea, why don't we cross-pollinate with the Cole Porter Society, and scouring the internet found that none existed. So she said, you're good on the telephone. Here's the number of the trust. I called the trust in L.A. They, in turn, called the law firm in Los Angeles.
So there was a Cole Porter Trust. Now, what is that?
They take care of the legacy of Cole Porter, and the law firm oversees the distribution of the funds, and the publishing company makes sure that you cross all the T's and dot all the I's mm-hmm. when you're licensed to do his work.
I'm curious, who benefits from that? Because he didn't have children.
Didn't have children, but the collateral part of his family that took over the family farm in 1952 when his mother died. He also willed some of his money to Ray Kelly, who was his driver and valet. So there's pretty healthy amount of money that comes in every year. In fact, I was just comparing, I was just doing a special research on Night and Day that's still in the top 10 producers for ASCAP of all time music. So he's, this many years, will have been dead 50 years this October.
Dead 50 years this October and very much alive.
That's right. And that's the hope of this society, basically.
So what made you want to join a Cole Porter Society? What made you even think of that?
Well, my thought was to perpetuate his legacy, because mm-hmm. young people today, if they know who he is, they know maybe his music. They know, well, Frank Sinatra may have sung that tune, or I may know Night and Day, or I might get Night and Day.
Well, how young a person do you have to be to remember Frank Sinatra? I mean, that's not a young person already. Sorry.
But he's such a legend in our society,
yes.
and he did that duets album towards the end of his life, and so a lot of younger people know him just as an icon. The on the television, you see ads now for Jack Daniels, for instance.
When you say young people, you mean high school age?
That's what we're going after, but even people in college and a little beyond, when you have graduated from music schools, when you say, I sort of know the name, but they don't know nearly as much as they should.
So why do you want people to know about him? What is the value to you?
It is a part of our American legacy, and mm-hmm. I think they are losing out if they don't know what came before and how to express themselves in a way that's more literate than what we hear.
But that's a big part of it.
Part of it's a value judgment.
I think it's a nice one.
The kids say what they say that reflects where they are. And I just want to make sure that when they get in their late 20s, when they get in their 30s, and they don't want to just say, baby, 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 let's get it on, they will have some romantic vocabulary in which to base
their feelings. So they can say baby, baby, baby if they want to, but not because they don't know anything else.
It should be a choice.
Okay.
And, you know, there are times when you say baby, 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 but not all the time.
Right.
And you may think
And not
your,
by default.
That's right.
Not because you're stuck with no other vocabulary.
That's right. Yeah. The difference between a hole in a grave is a rut in a grave is the size of the hole. So you want to keep moving on and digging down for something deeper in your life.
Yeah. I mean, that's true of all kinds of education. We should know as much as we can and then choose where we want to be on any continuum.
That's right. I mean, there is a fellow that I met this last week from The Economist. Now, it has a particular point of view. I think it's a little bit more objective than what we get here. But he has a point of view, and you want to read widely. And that's what he said, essentially. You should read widely. And if you agree with us, fine. But if you don't...
At least you'll know what we're saying.
And that's what Emerson said, essentially. Yeah. He did
not like
the fact that his books were required reading in school by the time he passed on. He wanted you to go out, experience life. And if you find that life coincides with what I've written and that you agree with, fine. But be yourself. Be yourself. As Oscar Wilde said, everybody else is taken.
Yes.
So, and he also said in his essay on self-reliance that trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that string. Sometimes our own thoughts come back to us with alienated majesty. If you thought of the Cole Porter Society, I might say, that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
But no, maybe it's not for me. And that's supposedly how Colonel House controlled Woodrow Wilson during World War I. He would suggest something. Wilson would go back and think about it and come back as if it was his idea and say, Wilson, I've just thought it brilliant, Mr. President. Except he let on, House did, what he was doing to control the president, and he was dismissed. But in forming this Cole Porter Society, it's taken us to places that we never thought we would go.
Now, you started with a couple of performances in the San Francisco Bay Area, right?
Right in the Bay Area. And then as a result... Someone contacted Dick Golden, who is an XM radio host on a show entitled Beyond Category, and he co-hosts the show with Tony Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick Golden got a hold of me and asked me if I would like to be on his program.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of nationalized us in a way in which we didn't think possible. We've become friends, and since then I've talked with Tony Bennett a couple of times about the Cole Porter Society, in which he is complete and total favor and support of. As a result of that, one of the women, young gals that we perform with to promote the Cole Porter Society to young people, she's 13 years old. Her father grew up in Peru, Indiana, which happens to be Cole Porter's hometown, where he was born June 8th, 1891. And so in the middle of rehearsal for our next performance, I looked down at my cell phone and it says, Peru, Indiana. I said, stop the music.
I knew.
And there she was, Joey Lubish, Kubish, I'm sorry, talking to me about Cole Porter and inviting us to the Cole Porter Music Festival, which my wife and I attended for 3 days, where I was a featured performer, and I'm going to be invited back next year.
Will you talk a little bit about what that was like being in Indiana around people that you don't have any maybe cultural connection to, but maybe you do?
Well, the interesting thing was getting out of Chicago and driving down, we tried to reconcile both the MapQuest, the GPS, and also Siri, but we finally did get there before dusk had hit, and they live on a farm.
That's what
Cole Porter's grandfather. I didn't live on a farm. All of a sudden, I'm up against cows and calves and cattle, and but very sophisticated community. The high school has an art gallery attached to it, which has Miro's, Matisse's, John Singer Sargent's, and Rodin's. She greeted us while she was feeding a cow. She called one of the names from Cole Porter's musical. At any rate, she welcomed us. We stayed there for 3 days. There was a fellow who came down from Chicago who's an expert on composers and did three lectures on Cole Porter, which were just delightful. The museum there, it's in Miami County, had anybody that wanted to sing a Cole Porter song could. And they also had featured performers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just delightful. The whole town gets involved every year around that time, and people come from around the world to this particular festival.
And smart and brilliant and talented and sophisticated lives everywhere now.
That's absolutely right. There's no geographical limitation. There's no geographical limitation.
So assume nothing when you go to the farm to meet the folks.
That's right. And it was a very
friendly town. Because
they
know who Moreau is.
It was subtitled The Friendly City, and the entire 3 days that we were there, there was not one discouraging word or thought. I really gained a lot more respect for the Midwest. Kind hearts and gentle people.
Yes. Nice.
Wonderful folks.
Yes.
And the beat goes on. We came back.
So kind of in a flash, just through, I mean, I just think this is so important. We live in an age where going viral suddenly means something.
That's right.
And that's what happens. I mean, not just on the internet.
We've had this for just a few months.
But you just swept the nation in a flash.
And we've had 500 people sign up and likes for the Cole Porter Society, and one thing just generates another.
Well, do you want to give any websites, by the way? I hate to interrupt, but like if people should want to join you here.
www.noahgriffin.com will give you all the information that you need.
www.noahgriffin.com.
And the most exciting thing that I forgot to mention, we just got back from New York after a side trip down to Los Angeles. A retired Capitol Record executive attorney wants to oversee what it is that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Big fan of Cole Porter's, who was almost hired by the law firm in New York. Now, one of my supporters said, you have to be in New York. So what I wound up doing was flying out to New York. It came so quickly, the opportunity, that we couldn't even book out of San Francisco or Oakland. We had to drive all the way down to San Jose to take a flight to get to New York City, where they debuted Les Ambassadors, a Cole Porter musical review that had not been done in America ever. It debuted 86 years ago in Paris. The music they thought was lost to history, but an archivist kept pushing and pushing and pushing by the name of Ken Bloom, found it in the University of Pennsylvania archive because the arrangement was originally done by Fred Waring.
Yeah.
George Gershwin was at the piano that evening. His sister Frances sang in Paris. Nobody saves archives or music from a nightclub review. They save it for musicals. And Cole Porter was lucky to get the job at that point.
Mm-hmm.
His big break came the next year in a musical called Paris.
And what year was that? Tonight?
This is 1928 with the Ambassadors. And the next year, 1929, came out Paris, which was huge. Let's Do It came from there, and Let's Misbehave came from there. It was produced by Ray Getz, Irving Berlin's former brother-in-law. So we got to hear 18 songs that had never been heard before of Cole Porter's, never been done before. A San Franciscan was attached to the evening. Peter Menton played the piano. Mm-hmm. Vince Giordano was the orchestra leader, and it was history. There were so many people.
How surprised are you at all this? Either enormously or not at all. I guess it's one way or the other.
Well, I am surprised that I'm able to make so much progress and just having one focus. Patricia Fripp always
and it's
said
such a short amount of time with not so much effort on your.
In
I mean,
a
it took
way,
off.
I've been preparing for it my entire life.
Okay.
I have been off alcohol for 36 years, which prepared me for this life where you're around alcohol all the time, and I have no temptations whatsoever.
Good.
I don't do sugar and flour. My weight is down. I have a focus now that I didn't have before. I have a happiness, a lightness of being, an increased spirituality, and an appreciation that what I am doing is important. When I had my law degree and I worked in government, politics, and media, I had a sort of pecking order in my mind that my music was secondary
mm-hmm.
and not really as important. But then I thought of Longfellow, who said, all are architects of fate, working within these walls of time, some with massive deeds and great, and some with ornaments of rhyme. But nothing useless is or low, each thing in its place is best, and what seems but idle show strengthens and supports the rest. Longfellow called his poems songs, and my songs are just as important as these other
yes,
things.
Yes, and by the way,
do.
When you think about it, I mean, you think about the whole history of music.
Yes.
And it binds people in a way that your work in politics, no disrespect intended, couldn't.
Tagore once said, God respects me when I work. He loves me when I sing.
Oh,
songs
yes.
bring people together in
yes.
a way in which politics, writing, media cannot.
And also with Cole Porter, I mean, there's such a specific beat, a specific rhythm, which helps because we are meant for that.
Well, and I believe, mm-hmm. and maybe I'm not sophisticated enough to understand it, but that rhymes really count.
Yes.
Rhymes mean something.
We are creatures who are born to a sense of rhythm. We live by it.
That's right.
We can't up heartbeat, EKGs,
that's
moon
right.
rising, the tides. I mean, I could go on for, I
and
won't.
And the planets, they
but
all
yes,
go
there
in
is,
certain
there
order.
Is
there's a mathematical order to
it. But there's also a perceptible beat.
Yes.
That we need. You know, when that beat, when that EKG goes funny beat, you're done.
You don't want to be
a flatliner.
The rhythm
is, mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
And Cole Porter has wonderful, sophisticated beats to his tunes. Mm-hmm. He has wonderful, sophisticated lyrics.
And that internal
witty,
rhyme that catches you.
Oh, he's just so good.
Yeah.
He's just,
yeah.
I put off learning some of his longer pieces because he helps you out with the rhymes, with the alliteration, with the consecutive thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Begin the Beguine is 60 bars when the average tune was far less than that. 32, Let's Do It was one of those list songs. An earlier hit that he had was Old Fashioned Garden, which was popular every place but in England because they knew he had flowers growing out of season. He never made that mistake again. He meticulously researched everything else that he did so that it's a species, it's a phyla.
But his intelligence kind of makes you pay attention in a way that's good for you, I would guess.
And beyond the average songwriter, I was listening to a tape of Yip Harburg the other day, who wrote Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and he said, I didn't have the advantage that Cole Porter had of Yale. And he wasn't putting it down, but he's saying, I kind of came up the hard way. Irving Berlin was America's songwriter. The average person could identify. You kind of stretch a little with Cole Porter because his the average person has a 17,000-word vocabulary. Shakespeare had a known 34,000 words that he used. He's much closer to that 34,000 than the average person. But
also,
he makes us aspire.
And yes, he makes us aspire. That's what I was getting at. Thank you. You did that in much shorter words. Perfect. So people like being around elegance.
They do.
I think they really
do.
I've seen people say, oh, I want to join and I know just what I'm going to wear to it. Now, how many people do that? You know, there's a requirement of personal thought. In these and I've noticed, I want to know, because the performance where I've been, and you offer the audience to sing along.
Yes.
And they just take it. It's as if you don't even need to be there. At that point, you could, because the music is theirs. You've made it so clear.
Just recently, I've done three performances of Brush Up Your Shakespeare. Not everybody knows the verse, but when I invite them in to Brush Up Your Shakespeare, start quoting him now, they all come in.
Yes.
And they'll be quiet for me to do the little version in between the chorus, but they all come in the chorus. And certainly two of his simplest songs were his biggest sellers, True Love and Don't Fence Me In.
Oh, yes.
And everybody knows them.
Yes.
You want to walk away from musical theater, it seems to me, but something which is hummable.
Oh,
something
yes.
that you can remember
yes.
that lightens your day
yes.
the next day. And that's no knock on some of the complicated musicals that are coming out today. But, you know, Damn Yankees, Oklahoma, Carousel are always going to be there.
Yes, I agree. I had a friend who was a producer, Broadway producer, and we were talking about something, and he said, you can't hum the lighting and whistle the costumes.
That's right.
And people do want to go away with that music as part of themselves internally.
Birds got to fly, fish got to fly.
You have some things here that I see that
yes,
you brought.
Yes, I do. Well, I brought some reviews of that Cole Porter show and also indicating that it was coming up and what historical significance that it indeed has.
Let's have the historical significance, please.
Well, it's like we talked about Matisse, Moreau, John Singer Sargent, Rodin. If you found an unearthed, heretofore undiscovered Rodin or Matisse, you would think, oh my God, that's just great.
Yes.
For a music lover, a Cole Porter lover, it's the same kind of thrill that you get. When you think you've completely covered all the 800 songs that we know he's written, and when Kimball says in his book, this is lost to history, we don't have these, and all of a sudden somebody finds in an archive somewhere songs that show you his evolution. He was moving from being a great college musical writer into being the sophisticated Porter that he was. He had a flop on Broadway after Yale called See America First, and the critics said See America Last. Then he went to Paris and to Venice and kind of licked his wounds, got married over there, came back. He did something called Beyond the Quota, which was very short but had a little notoriety, a little fame to it. And then he was evolving. And so you see the young Cole Porter right before he hits fame and hits his stride. So it's very important. It's like maybe finding a lost Abraham Lincoln letter or speech that he'd given that somehow is lost to history.
And things do surface.
Yes, they do.
They do surface. It may take 10 years, it may take 150.
Who knows? We might find the stuff from the lighthouse at Alexandria at some point. And digging.
What was the review?
I did read the review, and some reviews were sparkling. Others said there was nothing great in it, but it was nonetheless, you could see the embryonic wit and lilt of Porter as he was on his way to becoming famous. Tom Wopat was the only singer that evening that people would know. And as I said, Peter Minton was there. I would like to bring it to San Francisco because I think it would find a very warm reception here, especially with Peter's name. And we found a place like perhaps the Herbst Theater, which you get at least 600 people there. Maybe not a big venue, but an adequate venue.
Well, the things you've done, and you're, I shouldn't say one-man show because you've had some wonderful singers with
sure.
you. But essentially, I mean, not a huge production in terms of huge production. And there's packed. There's not a seat left. What is it that you're answering that people want?
Well, it might be what we talked about earlier, that need for elegance, that need for articulation, that need for a time where we thought that people were a little bit more sophisticated, times were simpler. I've often wondered why Fred Astaire and why Busby Berkeley and why those people flourished during the 30s. They were tough times. People wanted an escape, wanted to get beyond their humdrum life. Aspire to something a little bit. I know when I was in high school, I took vocabulary courses. I wanted to learn words that were beyond the words that I used. I memorized poems that had words in them that I didn't quite understand or know at that time. And one of the things my father said, always come back to a poem. If you don't even read a poem every 5 years, you bring a different person to it. Mm-hmm. So I see things in Cole Porter's songs now that I wasn't sophisticated to see as a youngster. Mm-hmm. And so if these kids don't learn it now, they won't be able to grow into it. Now,
what are you doing in the high schools? This is important.
Once a month, we go into a high school and we present.
I mean, as
the
long
program.
As we're talking about young people, and
And the kids respond because primarily I start off with a rap. I do that Roman rap, and because of that, they say, "Well, this isn't really the old fogey that we thought he was." And then I go into. I don't put what they have down. I just say, we have something different for you, something that you might grow into. And some of his songs are so clever. If they have any basis of Shakespeare, brush up your Shakespeare's there. Let's Do It, which was so suggestive at the time. Let's Fall in Love. Well, you know, kids, their hormones are raging in high school, so they can identify it. And they're studying biology, and birds do it, bees do it, et cetera. So they catch on pretty quickly, and they say, oh, that guy's pretty hip. It's like Paul Laurence Dunbar did a poem. It was a rap poem in the early part of the 1900s. And I do that for kids in Black History Month, and they go, oh, my God, maybe what we have isn't new. I love Truman's comment to a young aide. He once said, the only thing new in this world, young man, is the history you don't know.
Yes. So I was going to say, not only are you bringing music together, but you're bringing eras together.
Generations.
And letting people see that we're tied together.
We are.
That we say things differently at different times.
And now when people not wanting to go to rest homes, particularly and living in the home, I just heard a beautiful story the other day. A friend of mine's twice divorced in his early 80s. And his son, who has a large spread, said, Dad, I'm going to build you a cottage. I want you to know your 4-year-old grandson growing up. I thought, how wonderful. Multi-generational.
In terms of bringing together.
And the stories that 4-year-old will hear from the 80-year-old, he might remember. Who knows? I remember at 4 years old knocking over a jar of preserves and my father running down the aisle for me because I got scared in the Safeway store. And the clerk said, here comes your grandfather. I wonder, why did he say that? But I was so fortunate to have a father who was semi-retired for most of my early years and learn and know his stories. And then I can pass those on to my children and others. So history... It really doesn't become history till it's outside the firsthand memory of somebody that you know. For years, I sang at the 1906 earthquake celebration at Lotus Fountain. And I would marvel at the stories that I heard live from people who were living then, how they matched what I was reading in the books.
Well, I have a question for you, because I've always been interested in when does gossip become history? In other words, there was a lot about Cole Porter's life, and there was a whole Cartier exhibit at the museum, and a lot of the jewelry was hers. And somehow that was history. They had a picture of Grace Kelly with that diamond on her finger, and it seemed to me like gossip. So what's the, you know, there's some point at which.
Well, you know, Napoleon said that history is nothing but a fiction agreed upon. I suspect it depends upon who you talk to and what version you see and what's the collective. Like I always thought that America absolutely won the World War II. And now they're saying Russia had a big role to play in this. And, you know, you look at the history from different points of view. I'm sure the Mexicans look at the war with Mexico differently than we do.
Oh, I'm sure. But you're coming in, just to get back to Cobarde, you're coming in at a stage in his life where he's so long past.
Well, yes, and it's interesting. The part of the history
life
that was left out for so many years has come to the fore. But it never once came up in the 3 days I was in Peru, Indiana, what his sexual orientation was.
That too, yeah.
And I came to the conclusion that it, even in that day, it wasn't secret. It was private.
Oh, that's...
Everybody knew, but nobody talked about it unless he made it an issue. They don't say Janet Gallen, the heterosexual woman,
right, exactly.
Or Noah Griffin, the heterosexual
right.
male.
But it is historically important now.
Well, people want to know the totality of an individual, what made him who he was.
And one of our heroes is one of us.
If you put down someone or some group, they want to say, you don't need to put us down. Look at so-and-so who's a part of our group that made a significant contribution to world and American culture.
That's right. And that's really important.
Yes, it is. Everybody
needs
a place.
Because it's a way, again, of not isolating people who are going through some
difference. Or marginalizing them.
Thank you. Marginalizing, yes. I'm glad you have that vocabulary class. I'm delighted.
Hard to keep up with you, Janet Gallen.
There's so much to talk about, and we're limited on time, but maybe we'll do another one. But just because I'm about love letters, and you've written some great ones, I know, what about a letter, and I'm just going to ask you how you feel about this, because you're now an important part of this history, because you're bringing it back.
Yes,
and because you're renewing a whole world that might have gone to its grave, not really knowing about him.
Right.
What about a letter to yourself, and you just mail it, and just what you've done? Dear Noah, I just want to say I'm so proud of you for not giving up on this, and just like...
You know what I'm thinking? A letter from
heart.
The young Noah to the old Noah.
Better.
And thanking him, because the child
Perfect.
Is the father of
yes.
the man.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
thanking him for yes. finally coming back to what it is he was supposed to do.
I love that.
What's that?
And
along the fields he comes to me, the little child, the little lad I used to be. Let's see. Across the fields of yesterday, he sometimes comes to me. The little lad I used to be, and yet he smiles so wistfully once he has crept within. I wonder if he hopes to see the man I might have been.
Oh, yes. Oh, that would be wonderful. And then you mail it to yourself.
Yeah.
And I bet when you read it, you'll see what I know is always true, that the you who wrote it is not the same as the you who is reading it. But also, let somebody dig that up in 50 years.
Wow.
Because we just were saying before, things surface, and that'll be a piece of gold.
Every letter my parents ever wrote to me in college and in law school, and someday someone who cares enough will maybe try to put it together, and I see that's
the direction. Or someone who doesn't care and then finds them and realizes they do.
And that they're not alone, because there is nothing, Dostoevsky said, nothing human is alien to me.
Mm-hmm.
And we think everybody's life is individual, but it's not unique. And I think that we find that through reading letters, the emotions that people have, the things that they're concerned about, their love, their family, the dissension. It's all a part of the human
condition. And that's a very nice thing, by the way, finding out that we're individual, but not unique, because it's comforting. It gives us company, and it's actually humbling.
Yes.
Just should you think you're the center of any universe.
Right. There's no,
oh, thank
it's,
you.
It's very crowded at the center of the universe.
Yes. Oh, the edges are much better. Thank you so much
for
doing this. And I just want to encourage everybody to take part in the Cole Porter Society and go to what performances you can if you want an evening of effortless elegance. Thank you, dear.
Thank you.
And please remember, if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, every writing a love letter is a special occasion. And most of them, when found in 100 years, 200 years, are going to be historically significant in some way. And by the way, the letters will stand the letters will last. If you use good ink and good stationery, what you put on a video will not, because technology changes.
That's right.
So write it down and store it somewhere. Thank you, dear. Well, until next time, this is Janet Gallen and
Noah Griffin
saying goodbye.